today on Rocking the Suburbs.
It was like nothing I had ever heard when I first came across it. I mean, it was punk, but it wasn't. It was catchy. It was almost like the Monkees or something.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Rockin' the Suburbs. On behalf of Jim Lanahan, I'm Patrick Foster, welcoming you to this episode of our Paisley Underground series. Big thanks going out to Paul Hayden out there in Wilmette, Illinois, for all his preparation and passion for this subject. I think it's going to be really fun as we go through these days of episodes. Yesterday, if you didn't catch the first episode, you can go back and listen to our intro to the series and discussion of the Dream Syndicate and their landmark debut album, The Days of Wine and Roses. Today we're going to focus on another band from the Los Angeles area in general, the greater Los Angeles area, and that band is the 3 O'Clock. So without further ado, let's jump back into my conversation with Paul Hayden, and you'll hear us begin to discuss. What time is it? 3 o'clock. Now, the next band we're going to talk about here, I find very interesting for several reasons. And one of them being, it's one of the unusual guitar bands where the bass player was the lead singer. And there aren't a whole lot like that. But Paul, walk us through the story of the 3 o'clock and how they kind of, and as you already mentioned, the bassist gave the name to the movement. So this will be interesting to hear how this all came together.
We did. So the band started out as the Salvation Army. And in 1981, I think it's Los Angeles area, but again, I think separate from everybody else. They were definitely inspired by punk, but certainly had that 60s vibe going. The first thing they put out was a 7-inch single, Mind Gardens, on the New Alliance label, which you may have heard of because it was owned by
the Minutemen.
Minutemen were definitely into helping out the scene and signing new and exciting bands. And Mind Gardens and Happened were the first single that they released. And Mind Gardens is pretty funny because it's about Doris Day taking the wrong pill. Which I can't believe didn't get somehow get squashed or something by her or whatever.
Right.
Maybe she thought it was funny. I don't know, but I thought what a great little, not gimmick exactly, but a good hook to get
yes.
you interested in it.
Yeah.
So the band, I should probably introduce the band first. Yeah, Michael Curcio on vocals and bass, the lead singer and songwriter. And then Luis Gutierrez played guitar. And on the first Salvation Army album, the drummer is known as Troy. I don't have a lot of information on Troy, but he was, yeah.
If that was his name.
If that was even his name. But he stuck around for the first album, which is a great album. It's not the one we're going to focus on, but it's a great right. punk album because it's got a lot of, like, 60s. It's got some organ. It's got some psychedelic guitar, but it's really fast, which I really, really like. It was like nothing I had ever heard when I first came across it. I mean, it was punk, but it wasn't. It was catchy. It was almost like the Monkees or something on.
Yeah.
It was just a very refreshing album. And it was on the Frontier label, which was at the time a big one. I think Lisa Fancher was the one who started that and put out really good records by the Adolescents. I'm sure there's more. Maybe the first Social Distortion. I could be wrong there. Scrap that.
Thin White Rope, I think, put a record out on that label as well, which was kind of a cool, somewhat adjacent band.
Yes, yes. They are often mentioned as one of those other, like you said, adjacent bands.
Yeah.
So they had a pretty good start. Two pretty big labels, underground labels at the time, and recorded this self-titled album in May of 82. It did well. It made some noise and enough to get people interested in them. And then no surprise that they had to change the name of the band.
No.
The real Salvation Army came down and said, we kind of own that name, so you need to find something. So They chose the name The 3 O'Clock because that's the time they usually started band practice.
Interesting.
So Troy leaves and they pick up a guy named Danny Bonaire, who is kind of like the Dennis Duck of The 3 O'Clock. He had played in a band called The Quick and also one of the iterations of The Weirdos. So he was a name.
So yeah.
A good get. And he brought a really good power to the band, but not like crazy thrash drumming, just a good, powerful, almost like a Clem Burke type.
Yeah.
Really throwing the hammer down. And in addition to him, they brought in a keyboard player, Mickey Mariano, and decided that they had done, they had done the punk thing on the Salvation Army album. It's time to expand a little bit. We're ready to do some different things. So in the same year, 1982, they put out an EP called Baroque Hoedown, produced by Earl Mankey, who was a name at the time. And I guess I did not know this until I started doing the research. He played guitar for Sparks.
That's correct. Yeah,
so you can kind of hear that influence on this material, where there's not, the guitars are not as frantic. There's more keyboards. It's a little more, the psychedelia is a little more pronounced. And on the version that I have, they covered the Easy Beats, Sorry, which is a 60s. It would sound like very comfortable on Nuggets.
Yes.
And I remember reading that it was an Easy Beats cover, and at the time I'm like, well, I thought they only had that one song, Friday on My Mind.
Yeah,
and had no idea that this song even existed. I mean, you gotta remember too, with this story, it's the early 80s and information is not as easy to come by as it is now.
That's exactly right. Yep.
If you wanted some of these records, you had to go into classifieds in the back pages.
Yeah.
Rolling Stone, Trouser Press, whatever. It was just kind of cool that they would bring out these songs and expose it to people like me who had no idea. So they're moving quick. They're recording at a good pace. And then 1983, they decided to put together their first full-length album as the 3 O'Clock, and they're going to work with Earl Mankey again, and they put out the album I'd like to focus on, which is 16 Tambourines. It's, I guess you could say, just to make it simple, they're more of a power pop band now than a punk band, but I think it works to their favor. I think the songs are more diverse. They're definitely finding their own sound, and it's more interesting. Because you can play fast, and it's great, but after a while, you get kind of bored. So, as a side note, we will say they do cover the Bee Gees.
And there's the connection.
There's the connection in my own time, which was on Bee Gees first. Again, right, when right. I was reading, and I was one of those nerds who would read the liner notes and see who wrote what. And I see, you know, B. Gibb, R. Gibb, like, what? I don't know this.
It has to be the Bee Gees.
Gotta be. So again, I mean, they're doing, you know, they're doing the work, getting these songs exposed to people that don't know any better. And it is great. I mean, the first song is probably the one, if you knew a 3 O'Clock song, it's probably Jet Fighter. Where you hear like Dana Benares drumming really propels this one, and everybody's on target. It's just a great, great song, including the kind of sound effects near the end, the pilot in the cockpit.
Yeah.
Some, I don't know what he says, but those little touches, I think probably Earl Mankey's idea, but good stuff. I mean, this is on an independent label, but it sounded like it could have been easily fit on a major label. I mean,
yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't weird or all that different. I think they just wanted to make good songs, like the ones they liked growing up in the 60s stuff and all that. So the reaction, I believe, was a little bit mixed at the time. I think there was some of, the OG fans who probably felt they were a little too twee. And there are some songs that are a little on the mellow side, but I think they all fit in nicely. But I think it's really good. I mean, top to bottom, again, we're talking about each song being kind of a distinct entity, but when you put them all together, it really flows well. I think Curcio put together his best batch of songs. I think they use, there's a great use of horns on When Lightning Starts. That's one of my favorites. That's mm-hmm. the penultimate song. Nice way to segue into the last one, Seeing is Believing, which kind of brings you back down and sends you home with a nice quiet buzz.
I think this record has aged really well, and I can understand why in the contemporary time of 83 that a lot of people didn't necessarily like the vocals. Maybe, you know, they were a little too reedy, or, you know, whatever you wanted to call them. And maybe they thought the keyboards were mixed a little bit too high or something like that. But when you look back on it, it is, as you said, a really strong record. And just over the albums that we were talking about, the music that was recorded by the 3 o'clock, you know, and they, even on this record, they use the English spelling of tambourines, right? So they were definitely embracing this whole kind of thing with, you know, Baroque hoedown the same way. But to me, you know, they always, to me, like, seemed like the band with the biggest record collections, or that, you know, they were into the most weird, you know, stuff, not only because of the covers they did, but just the way all the little touches, you know, were in the music. And I probably didn't understand how diverse their influences were, you know, when I first heard this album. But I really think you go back and listen to it today and it sounds incredible. You know, I don't think you would ever peg it as an 83 album. You know, it could come from any time, really, because I think the influences are so well integrated into this record, and there is a real vision to it. You know, it didn't sound like, and it doesn't sound like a whole lot of other stuff that's out there. It's a very distinctive record. Like you mentioned, the horns, and I think of all the, you know, the Paisley Underground bands, they made the most interesting use of keyboards, and it were just very, very different. Now, I looked this up earlier today in preparation for our recording session, and I remember very distinctly seeing the 3 o'clock play live. The year was 1985, and they opened up once again. Here we go. REM. REM was given, you know, they gave bands chances. This was at, and of course, with the magic of Setlist FM, etc., you can find out that it was August 29th, 1985 at DAR Constitution Hall, which is a venue in Washington, D.C., where I think it was owned by the Daughters of the American Revolution or something, and they would have like recitals in there and stuff, you know, when they first built it, and whenever it was built. It's an old building. It's a very plush kind of a theater, but it, you know, starting in the 70s and 80s, they had a lot of rock shows there. And I just remember like, wow, these guys are amazing. And they were wearing, you know, like really cool clothes. Like, I don't think I'd ever seen a band wearing button-down shirts buttoned all the way up to even the top button without a tie, you know. It's like, wow, these guys have a real look. Yeah. And I think your mention of Clem Burke is right on the money. That, you know, that was the kind of sound I got, like that powerful drum sound from them, and just, you know, ripping through an opening set. I just, you know, remember exactly what they played. I'm sure they played Jet Fighter and others, but I just remember it being really, really good, but also struck by them visually. All these, you know, really, really skinny guys with, you know, the button-up shirt and the sort of dress shoes with jeans and things like that. They had a real look to them that was really cool and really authentic. And I don't know. Do you agree that this record really holds up today?
Absolutely. It sounds... like you said, it's not a 1983 record. It's just a great record. If it came out today, people would probably be drooling over it. Like,
oh my gosh, amazing. Of course, yes.
You know, but what I think also works in its favor is like the other bands. I mean, they were playing what they wanted. They're on an independent label, probably not getting any kind of pushback. Like, you make the record you want, and we'll put it out.
Yep.
I think they did that. They did what they needed to do. After this, now, you know, we see another trend. They signed to, I believe, Paisley Park, or did they go to IRS?
I know they went to IRS at some point. I'm not sure if it was on this one or the next one. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, again, the rough edges were removed, and there were some good songs. I think Arrive Without Traveling's the next one. And
yeah, that's right.
Mm-hmm. There's some good things there, but nothing like, you know, the Baroque Hoedown and 16 Tambourines. It just seems like the magic was gone. And they'd made maybe one more after that. And then kind of just Curcio did his own, couple other bands, Permanent Green Light, Jupiter Effect.
Mm-hmm.
There's more. And then I get in 2012, I believe they agreed to play Coachella and did a brief reunion. And then in 2013, there'll be something we get to later where they get together and make some more music. But we'll hold off on that for now.
Okay. Okay. yeah. And a really good band. And I think they, to me anyway, of the four bands we're going to discuss, are the second most psychedelic
of the four. but
they blended it in really, really well. You know, Paisley and Baroque and Tambourine, spelled like the English way, definitely makes you think of psychedelia and, you know, like the Incredible String Band and stuff. But they're just a very, very unique band. And, you know, like you were mentioning earlier, they came from punk. They played fast, but it wasn't distorted.
It did sound a little bit like a weird Monkees, you know, like an inverse kind of a monkey. So,
They just remained to me a really, really charming band. One of the most fun and interesting of all the Paisley Underground bands. They really retain that spirit of playfulness of the Nuggets kind of a generation.
Yeah, I think they followed their gut and played what they wanted to. And I think, you know, when you've got the songs, you can do these kind of goofy things and it still holds up. They weren't psychedelic for the sake of being psychedelic. They just thought, you know, what would go really good here would be harpsichord or whatever.
And
it all worked. So
that's a great point. Yes. Matt, I couldn't have said it better. Very, very well said. We'll be right back. the Paisley Underground.